Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
What does fire you up? What makes your soul sing?
Sing? You know, it's the most ordinary stuff in the world. Because you asked me something like, what's saving my life now? Mm-hmm. And I sort of ended up with good friends, good food, good work, and good health. And it's so boring, but is there anything better? I mean, somebody asked me this week, what would break me? What would really break me? And it would be the loss of my love, my husband, and the loss of my health. I think those would break me. Because I don't have a lot of demands of how God has to be. Mm-hmm. How the divine has to come to me right now. Mm-hmm. I don't have many. I have a lot of demands on other people's behalf. But I guess the hugest spiritual accomplishment of my life at present is working less. Maybe not quite buying the definitions of success that I've been handed. Sounding more boring, less inspired. Being less of a hero. Somebody said the other day something like, well, I knew you when, you know, you've backed off and you're not doing so much now, but I knew you when you were somebody, kind of that sort of thing, which is a really odd measure. So to practice more and more detachment of that feels like liberation, which is my best definition of salvation. You know, the freer people can be to be, perhaps, and to be for other people is a great measure of God's activity. So what's saving my life now is, as best I can, finding a life with some balance and agility in it that has less exhaustion in it, less hypervigilance in it, less control needs in it. And life will force that on me sooner or later. So maybe I'm practicing, you know, surrendering a little vigilance now.
Crosspoint, I stumbled across that video. Barbara Brown Taylor is one of my favorites, so it's not unusual that I was listening to her wisdom, but it was actually the interviewer that caught my attention this time, because he asked this question, what's saving your life today? And I just couldn't shake it, because I can list plenty of things that are killing me right now, that is sucking the life out of me. And I won't list them because I'm sure you've got a list of your own. Plus, I already gave that top 10 list over coffee with my girlfriends this week, and you don't need a rehash. But you can pause for a moment if you want and think about a few things that are sucking the life out of you right now. It's not difficult, right? Sorry to start on a bit of a downer, but my point is, it doesn't take much brain power to do that, does it? But rarely do I stop to dwell on things that are life-bringing. So I want us to hold on to this question, what is saving your life right now, as we walk through some New Testament passages together. And this is the narrative of Zacchaeus, the tax collector, and we read it in Luke chapter 19. He, Jesus, entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. So he, Zacchaeus, hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and say, he is gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner. And Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much. And then Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost. So just a bit of context. Jesus and his followers were on their way to Jerusalem and they decided to make a stop in Jericho. Perhaps coincidence, perhaps not. Now the chapter before, chapter 18, tells us that along the way to Jerusalem, they had also had two encounters with two interesting and very contrasting fellows. The first was this well-educated, wealthy young ruler who was desperate to secure the one thing he didn't have and couldn't purchase, eternal life. Or at least eternal legacy, to be remembered after his death, whether physically or not. But he was unable to relinquish the things he had put the most trust in, his material possessions that made him feel safe and secure and in control. So the rich young ruler walked away without the thing he wanted most, salvation that would have cost him selflessness and generosity. It's the first encounter. The second encounter was with this impoverished blind beggar who had next to nothing and therefore nothing left to lose. And from his spot on the sidewalk, the beggar heard the crowd rumbling that Jesus was coming, Jesus was coming, and he recognized the possibility of his life being saved that day. So the beggar began to shout over and over to Jesus to heal him, which became so annoying that the crowd told him to knock it off, which only made him louder. Until Jesus eventually noticed him and came to him and gave him the one thing he wanted most, salvation through vision, which meant new opportunities, and salvation through reconnection with his community in a way that he hadn't been able to have before. And it was after those two encounters that Jesus found himself in Jericho. Now, today, Jericho is thought to be the oldest continually inhabited city in the world. As far as archaeologists and historians can tell, people have been continually living in Jericho since about 9,000 BCE, which, if you believe the myths, according to some, is when the lost city of Atlantis would have disappeared. Currently, Jericho is located in the West Bank of Palestine. So during Jesus' time, Jericho was considered a paradise. In Hebrew, it was called the City of Palms because of all the palm trees that had been planted, which gave it this oasis-type quality in an area that was surrounded by desert. The King Herods, multiple of them, they'd put up winter palaces, they'd put up gardens, they'd line the streets with sycamore trees. It had pools and villas and potted plants. It was also the center of a major trade route, and it was known for its healing and fragrant balms and dates. And it's actually said to have been the city that Mark Antony gave to Cleopatra as a token of his affection. And everybody knows you don't give a woman you love junk, especially if the woman you love is Cleopatra. So Jericho was something. And the bottom line, it was a nice place. And this magnificent city is where Zacchaeus, the chief tax collector, had chosen to live. And I would imagine the real estate wasn't cheap, but Zacchaeus could afford it. He was chief tax collector, which is the only time this position is mentioned in the New Testament, the chief tax collector. There were only three main Palestinian tax districts at this time. So he was one of three really important people. And not only did it make Zacchaeus an important somebody in regional politics and society, it provided him with plenty of funds and power. Tax collectors were kinds of contractors that were outsourced by the Roman Empire because the Romans didn't want to waste any of their own human resources. So they employed individuals within communities to collect taxes among their own people. The Romans also didn't want to waste their financial resources, so they didn't pay very much. And so the only way tax collectors could make a substantial living was by charging more than what was required by the government and keeping the extra for themselves. As chief tax collector, Zacchaeus was extra prosperous at the expense of his relatives and neighbors, and it also made him complicit and responsible for participating in a system that perpetuated poverty in his own community. So you can imagine this didn't make him popular with his neighbors. For the Jewish community as well, there was also this undercurrent of religious opposition to taxes, because collected funds went to support what they considered a secular government who openly worshiped what the Jewish community considered pagan gods. So, in the eyes of some, tax collectors were also funders and enablers of idol worship, which was a violation of their Ten Commandments. So there was a reason that tax collectors and sinners were often lumped together in the biblical text, because for many, the words were often viewed interchangeably. Now, Zacchaeus was the type of person that got invited to all the parties and important events, but was friends with very few. And you wanted to be on his good side, because that might come in handy one day in the form of a tax break or a favor, or really just being ignored. Now, Zacchaeus' name is the Greek form of a Hebrew name that means righteous or upright. Talk about not living up to expectations. Whoever had named Zacchaeus had had bigger plans for him. He probably had bigger plans for himself. I doubt many Jewish kids came home saying, "I want to be a tax collector when I grow up." Now, the Bible doesn't tell us how or why Zacchaeus took the job of chief tax collector, but maybe he simply saw it as a way to care for his family. Maybe he had daughters to provide dowries for, or college tuitions coming up. Maybe he had grown up in hunger and poverty and had sworn to himself he would never do that to his kids. Or maybe when he was younger and more vulnerable, he'd been approached by the right people at the right time with promises of big money and power and fulfilled dreams. Maybe he just stumbled into it. Maybe he'd chosen it. We don't know. But I imagine he often found himself collecting money from childhood friends and sweethearts, even family, who looked at him and thought, "What happened to you, Zacchaeus? Don't you remember? We used to climb trees together as kids. Our families are friends. You know my children." But Zacchaeus would pocket their money with callus, maybe to numb himself to what he was doing, or to better himself, as those he once called family and friends watched Zacchaeus' house get bigger, his clothes get more expensive, his food get richer, all on their backs. So whatever it was that got him to where we meet him in Luke chapter 19, Zacchaeus had become that guy. The guy who found himself in a crowd of people, completely alone and unrecognizable to anyone he had cared about. He had lost himself. He was in the middle of things that were killing him. But something had shifted in Zacchaeus that made him desperate to see Jesus, the guy that he had heard had a reputation of hanging out with tax collectors and sinners, of which Zacchaeus knew he was both. And he'd run out of friends and options, and he was looking for something else, something to save his life. So he had to at least see what Jesus was all about, maybe for his own prestige or out of desperation, who knows? But it made Zacchaeus take a pretty big risk. Pushing through that crowd alone was a big risk for Zacchaeus, because not only was he one of the most hated guys around, we're told he was a smaller guy, small enough for it to be worth mentioning. All it would take would be one disgruntled elbow to the ribs or to the temple, and Zacchaeus would have been on the ground, trampled by the crowd. No one would have been the wiser. Nobody would have cared. When Zacchaeus pushed his way through the crowd to get to Jesus, I'm sure they pushed back. But desperate times call for desperate measures, and that made him set aside his dignity, run to the front of the crowd, and do what few men of his age or position would do. That prominent figure, that high-ranking community member in his tailored suit and Rolodex, climbed a tree. And I'm just curious, when is the last time that you climbed a tree? I can't think of when I did. It's not the most dignified of pastimes, especially after you've reached a certain age, and especially when you're particularly small in stature, and especially when you're wearing the equivalent of that day's Armani. Climbing trees is for kids, not short, hated, prominent older businessmen. But at that moment, desperation and climbing trees were saving Zacchaeus's life. Zacchaeus climbed the tree, but it was actually Jesus that initiated conversation with him. We're not told that Zacchaeus was waving or shouting to him like the blind beggar was. Because right underneath that tree, Jesus set up a lunch date. He didn't ask Zacchaeus if he could come over. He told him he was going to his house, and he had better meet him there with some charcuterie. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." Zacchaeus wasn't used to getting orders. He was used to giving them. He agreed anyway, though. And maybe Zacchaeus was simply curious about Jesus. Maybe Zacchaeus was patting himself on the back for securing lunch with such an infamous guy. Maybe he heard Jesus was friends with guys like him, and he found himself so desperate he was willing to try anything, even allowing a poor, controversial, wandering teacher to invite himself over for lunch. I've felt that desperate before. Have you? Maybe Zacchaeus recognized that this lunch might just save his life. I'm sure Zacchaeus wouldn't have liked the comparison, but in his desperation, he was actually acting more like the blind beggar than the rich young ruler. We don't know how long Jesus stayed at his house, but by the time he left, Zacchaeus, also unlike the rich young ruler, had decided on some pretty significant life decisions. He was going to give half of his wealth away to the poor and repay four times what he had stolen. Zacchaeus understood what this meant. He was no dummy. This would cost him something. And according to Roman law, if you defrauded someone, you needed to repay them fourfold. Jewish law required fourfold restitution in cases of violent robbery that resulted in deliberate destruction. So Zacchaeus had all his bases covered: legal, societal, religious, cultural. Zacchaeus's payment was an admission of guilt, and he was making reparations. Now, some of you may know, but in 1941, there were about 120,000 Japanese Americans that lived in the United States. About two-thirds of them had actually been born and raised in the United States. And after the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, suspicion of Japanese Americans reached a fever pitch, and the U.S. government forced a majority to leave their homes and properties and move into one of 10 internment camps, which they called relocation centers at the time. These were across the country, most in the West and a few in Arkansas, and they were there for most of the war, so 3+ years. They were often only given a couple days' notice that they would be processed and then relocated for an indeterminate amount of time. This was, of course, a violation of their constitutional rights, but the justification was national security. Housing was mostly tar paper, army-styled barracks, shared by 4 to 5 families, shared restrooms, and the camps were surrounded by barbed wire and guard towers. And even though it was determined that Japanese Americans did not pose a significant threat, they were forced to remain in the camps. It's estimated later that the cost to Japanese Americans was about $400 million in property loss, not to mention the cultural changes that happened within the Japanese American community because of their internment. In 1948, the U.S. government paid $38 million in reparations. And then in 1988, they paid another $20,000 and gave a formal presidential apology from Ronald Reagan to each surviving individual who had been in the camps. So in 2019, Evansville, Illinois passed the first reparations law in the U.S. history, and it aimed to provide $20 million to Black Americans who'd been affected by housing discrimination, which contributed greatly to the racial disparity and the racial wealth gap that we have in our country. California is currently the only state with a task force that in 2023 gave their state legislator recommendations for reparations for repairing the damage of slavery and racism within their state. So the country is watching this city and this state to see if what they've done might be blueprints for further reparations for the financial ramifications of slavery and institutional racism. So the U.S. government's also paid reparations to coal miners, to farmers, to fishermen, just to name a few. So reparations is not a foreign idea in the United States. Now, Zacchaeus's reparations were also an acknowledgement that the system that he had been a part of was crooked. And his reparations were an act of repentance. They were a hope of being restored to his community. Reparations were saving his life that day. This wasn't just a lunchtime change of heart. It was a lifestyle change that could greatly reduce his status and his circumstances and his paychecks. It would affect his employees, his servants, his family. But perhaps that decision was saving his life that day. We don't know very much about the lunch conversation that was going on when Jesus was there, but we know that Jesus started it by telling Zacchaeus, "I am coming to your house today." And he ended it by saying, "Today salvation has come to this house," because he too, Zacchaeus, is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost. He called Zacchaeus a son of Abraham. In other words, Zacchaeus belonged in the community. He had always belonged, despite having lost his way. He belonged before Jesus entered his front door. He belonged while he was defrauding people, and he belonged after he left. That hadn't changed. But the salvation that had come somewhere in that time was something different. And notice there's no public condemnation from Jesus here. Remember, just a few verses back when the rich young ruler had decided radical generosity was too costly, Jesus actually hadn't condemned him either. He'd simply sighed and said, "It's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven." But he didn't say it was impossible, because that day, Zacchaeus had gone through that needle. Jesus wasn't condemning wealth. He was condemning exploitation and systems that created and perpetuated poverty and harm. Nowhere does it say that Zacchaeus gave up all his wealth and became destitute. It doesn't say he quit his job as a tax collector, but it does imply that he stopped profiteering. Jesus also said, "For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost." Apparently it was Jesus who had been doing the seeking all along, not Zacchaeus. So no matter how hard he had run to get in front of the crowd or how many scrapes he had from climbing that tree, he was being sought after first. It's a nice feeling to know that we're sought after. There's no fancy word or Greek translation of the word lost here. It's just like my phone half of the time, not where it's supposed to be. And over the years, particularly in some Christian circles, this sentence has been conflated into something overly spiritual, like Zacchaeus had been lost as in damned or doomed. But the word lost here simply means in the wrong place. Jesus wasn't making a conversion statement. Zacchaeus was already a part of the family, albeit on the fringe and not liked, but his foundness meant he'd rediscovered, remembered how he fit in, his rightful place. He had been made whole. He was back where he belonged. He was restored. Zacchaeus's generous choice to change was a practice of the greatest commandment, to love his community, his neighbors, his friends, his family, as he loved himself, which meant no longer participating in the corrupt system that had put a few ahead and impoverished the rest. Zacchaeus's reparations had both personal and communal ramifications, because the community would ultimately benefit from his return to generosity. He was rediscovering his place in community and finding himself. Change, wholeness, generosity, restoration were saving his life. Sometimes we can get so caught up in ourselves and all the things that we can get a little lost. So all the stuff today we saw, salvation through selflessness and generosity, salvation through restoration to community, salvation through tree climbing, salvation through lunch with a new friend, salvation through reparations, through liberation, salvation through wholeness and being found. So my question is the same as it was at the beginning. What is saving your life today? Whatever it is, however big or small, what is it that brings you joy and hope and life? Maybe let's spend some time dwelling on that today. And if we can't find that thing, maybe we need to do a little searching for it. Let's end with that question. What is saving your life today? Thanks, Crosspoint.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.